Okay, this is our third session on this theme of what is democracy. We began with Benjamin Barber's article back in 92 in the Atlantic Monthly. We've sort of progressed beyond its parameters in our last session. And so Derek and I are going to go at this problem from the angle of the big picture, I guess. Derek, what thoughts do you have today about what one does about democracy? Is there a democracy? Can there be one?
We can keep some of it left, whatever transformation we go through. I'm sure we won't lose all of it, but we certainly lose most of it. And whenever I have a problem with finding out what's going on under the name that we have traditionally given to things, I go back to the origin of the name, which is what McLuhan actually recommended, because he used to do that. He used to read a page of the dictionary to find out the story of the words.
Yes.
Democracy is the accomplishment of a Greek society that has, or an Athenian society that has been at it for over 100 years. It starts with Draco, goes along with Solon, catches up with Cleisthenes, and eventually gets to Pericles. Democracy becomes the power given to the people to avoid tyrants and to avoid the endless struggles between tribal and families. So as a principle of social organization, it was given a great deal of test, run the show before it actually happens. So where we are today is at the cusp of a different kind of ground. Democracy was related evidently to the alphabet. It was born sort of with it. It was born with writing. It was born with the idea that, each individual citizen was separate from the tribe and was an individual. And so democracy was implied power by the people as individuals, not just by the people as a mass, although that took a while, I think, to really develop. And I think Cleisthenes was responsible for that, because what he did was he replaces the phratres, which were the tribal associations and alliances, by the tritias, and the tritias were the design of the Athenian ground in geometrical form that actually defined zones of citizenship, so to speak, and made equal the people in those zones, as opposed to simply by leaving geography to the phratres. Obviously, the power was the ground. It always has been. Look at the caliphate today. The power was the ground. But taking the ground away, lifting literally the social from the ground, I call it the moment of Antaeus, because it's like, Hercules picking up Antaeus and pushing up in the sky, because the more Antaeus was connected with his mother, Gaia, the earth, more he was powerful. So that's a really, really powerful moment in the history of democracy. Now, what's going on is that the power of the people as individual is gradually leaning towards the power of the people again as groups. Look at Donald Trump and Tea Party and all the stuff that goes on. Or the social media. There is that. But then all these people in groups can also be manipulated, and manipulated in such a way by their very own networking that they are deprived of any real power. So the idea is, if democracy is still the power of the people, demos and kratos, kratos is power, if it's still demos and kratos, then we should assume that the association of all the tribes of the world, including the jihadists and all that, that the association of all the tribes of the world agrees on sharing more or less in a civilized way a common space that they actually recognize as common, which is the planet. And, of course, many things are trending towards that way. Certainly the ecological movement. The good news is that the Greens have won against the fascists in Austria. That's still democracy. And so the trend is towards a social agreement, a global social agreement. Not necessarily global social government, but a global social agreement on sharing in what we can still call a civilized way. That space. We'll get there. We have to get there. And that's what would be left of democracy. But when you look down very clear, and you don't have to go very far, into the practice of democracy by the countries that declare themselves, I love it. You know, all the countries like the Democratic Republic of China, give me a break, you know, of the Democratic North Korea. That's a real democracy. But no, what I'm saying, if you look into the people that are supporting it, and particularly the Americans, the Canadians, the Europeans, so on, all these people agree onto a mythology of democracy that they don't really practice. And certainly not in the world of business or in the world of government and their collusion. I'm sure you've seen Inside Story like everybody else.
Yes.
And you know what that means. Well, that's really not democratic. And I think that another thing that Barber said in his wonderful article about Jihad versus Macworld was that neither the Internet nor the traditional, you know, neither the media nor the consuming society are actually going to lead us to better democracy. Far from it. And he finds that we will be caught between the fascism of a military organization and the fascism of a business organization. And so, you know, he's got a point. But I believe that there is an avenue for a democratic ideal to be, because democracy is shared, and we are in a sharing world, badly, unevenly.
Yeah.
Not, sharing is not distributed everywhere, as Bill Gibson might say. But no, there is no question that we have an avenue. The world has an avenue. And I believe that it will happen. But whether our individual rights and our separation, our very private identity, all that stuff is just gone. That's gone. So that was the foundation of democracy seen in a certain way. If you change your vision of democracy, yes, it'll survive. If you keep it to that level, if you think democracy is based absolutely in the individual person's full rights and, you know, privacy and all that stuff, forget it. I don't believe that's going to happen.
Right. So do you remember in the 60s or in the 70s and 80s, they talked about people would be able to vote through the Internet or for the computer networks of those days, and they worried about mob rule, that an issue would come up and there'd be a mass, a referendum,
mm-hmm.
and everybody in the motion of the moment would vote for something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that happening in politics, technical politics, not the daily news panic, but in an election? Will they bypass the parliamentary or Republican bureaucracy ever and come to just people? Because if they don't have any private identity, it's all sharing a mood, then we're going to become a mob mentality, a hive mind, and we'd want to be able to participate in every decision. Do you think Western identity can take that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, that would be the origin of many civil wars.
Yeah.
Because, no, really. So you have to be very careful about that. And I think the government will be, and all governments will be, and they will probably unite on the basis of saying, look, there is a law. You cannot do a referendum in such circumstances, and just go ahead, don't do it. But of course, if governments are weak and they let it happen, they might have something very difficult to handle on their hands. Because if instant and permanent referendum, well, in ideal world, it's ideal. But we're not in an ideal world. We're in a world full of very bad rabbits.
Right.
So I don't see that as. But ideally, yes, of course. Ideally, we should be able to, evaluate decisions the way we evaluate our economy and the way we evaluate our investments. I mean, you should. It's already in the way in that, depending on how many people are asking for the same plane, the prices shoots up very quickly. How do they do it? They do it by collecting all that information about people who have the same opinion. I'm not talking about opinion here. I'm talking about the same desire, but it's the same thing here. They put it all together, and bingo, you'll find that you've had a referendum on that plane. I'm not saying there's room for everybody, but I'm saying that's what we're going into, these automated referenda that make it very difficult to escape the possibility that they will be used much more powerfully in politics and require a very strong reaction on the part of the people in power, you know.
Right. Now, I would call it the TV landscape, the TV body. This referendum is taken 24/7 through polling.
Mm-hmm.
The polling is already supposedly monitoring what the people are saying, and the bureaucrats have to respond to that. Now, you say we can't have a private identity anymore, but are we still going to, like we're doing now, keep this charade, or it's the only stopgap of, I don't know what you call it, bureaucratic one-man, one-vote politics that we're witnessing now and we witness every 4 years or every year with elections, even though that is not what is determining anything anymore and has no power, do you think just that form, the old form, will do it? No, you don't. You say we can't have a private identity and democracy won't look like what we're witnessing now, this after image. So what is the change that would not be the mob rule, which is the polls today anyways? See, I don't think we can even define where we're at. You can't make a univocal statement about what's happening without all these other contradictions coming in if you actually include all the factors that we environmentally live, mm-hmm. what I call the multiple body world.
Mm-hmm.
You see that we are not admitting that we can't explain, and nobody could be in a leadership position to make a decision. You know, you see in all the TV shows about Washington, it all goes back to, in the end, the president's got to make a decision. One guy. We keep this illusion of this one guy that's going to make the final decision. You know, you see that in the various, like, House of Cards.
Yeah, it's happened. It's happened before, and it is dangerous. That's why I think Trump is not going to, you know, not make decisions. Although I've heard this theory, it was that maybe it was the last talk, that he was actually collecting all the, he was collecting information about what was the current issues on internet, and then he was just addressing those issues without actually bothering to have a platform. That's, you know, you remember we came up with this wonderful discovery that he never finished his sentences.
Yes.
He was, you know, we were in a paratactic order. Well, we are. That's already a huge break from the past. But let's say that, and I read this probably in the New York Times anyway, that he actually was collecting information by people who are helping him to find it in big data and other things on what were the people grumbling about. And then as soon as he hit via the social media probing and the data analytics, the kind of topics that were burning for a great number of people, he would just address that one. Whether he believed in it or not had nothing to do with it. So he said that's another aspect of an absolutely undemocratic approach. Now, will he have the power to fool around? Well, yes, he will take the power to fool around. Obama didn't. That was his problem.
Yeah.
Obama didn't take the power to fool around. He was. I guess he must have been a bit afraid for his own skin. I mean, after all, murdering president is an American habit.
Yeah.
So he would have been careful, but he would also have been careful to be able to support some of the things he wanted to accomplish. So there's all kinds of things, but he didn't cut through the shit. He just didn't.
Right. Now, there is the fact that we're so super, McClellan would say super angelized, but also super decentralized, that groups and subcultures are taking things in their own hands anyway.
Yes.
You know?
Well, they are. This is the big danger, and that's what a democratic... I mean, that was the case already when Solon started putting together a legal format in order to get all the tribes to assemble. He called himself like, you know, he was like a goat or a sheep surrounded by absolutely ferocious dogs. He just felt it was awful. And
yeah.
These are thugs. I mean, thugs are meant for governments. You can see that.
Yeah.
How do you prevent a thug to arrive to the power is going to be a major issue. But
yeah.
They are thugs. They really are. There's no question about it.
Do you think that Trump is actually a thug?
Of course he is. Has been all his life. He's a financial thug. Has shown it many times. Totally ruthless. And he is a ruthless user of the media right now and the power that the media give him, which they shouldn't, but that's their bloody fault. No, he is absolutely ruthless.
Was Berlusconi a thug?
Yes, he was a thug, but he was also ruthless, but he was more fun.
Yeah, yeah.
He was ruthless in an Italian way. And the Italians are, in their ways, ruthless, Ben. ruthless people. They've got lots of mafia, Camorra, 'Ndrangheta. They have different tribes. That's tribes. All these mafia tribes.
Yeah.
You know that when the mafia is actually Sicily, right? But when the Camorra in Naples misbehaves, the big threat is, we'll bring the guys from Sicily.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's where all those murders were in the 80s. They killed the judges. They killed the military people.
Oh, no. They are ruthless.
As a side thing, I'm not following the news closely, so you're in Italy. Is the mafia weaker now, or are they the same they were 30 years ago? Do you know?
There is a dance going on between the powers that be, the police, the judges. Everything is negotiable in Italy. Everything, particularly among enemies. This is the better side of it, you could say. But you know, everything's negotiable. You can buy. I can't say you negotiate everything by money. It's not that. It's by power and who you know and who can have action about on you. This is the way kids are trained in Italy to handle their problems, social problems.
Right.
It's very different from the French. The French educate you to be the best, the brightest, the strongest, and you can just smash the guy if you don't like him. That's not the Italian way.
What's the American way then?
I know the guy who's going to give you a problem.
Comparing the French and Italians, what is the American way? You as a European, what do you see as the American way the kids are educated, conditioned?
That America is the strongest, the greatest, and that being an American gives you all the rights in the world because reality is made in America and nowhere else.
Okay, so they're above the fray. They're not negotiating, or they're not going to question their opinion.
Let me handle this. You know, American, the father, the government, the expert. Let me handle this.
Yeah,
I can handle this. And then you just go the bank. Just don't worry about your money. I'll take care of it.
Okay.
Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it.
Have you read any of William Irwin Thompson's books?
Yes, but it was a long time ago. They were very illuminated, and also very very insightful. But I never found him as, attractive to me anyway, as McLuhan, for finding out where we're going.
Yeah.
But I did. I did find a few things. But, I mean, the time it takes for a falling object to light, was that one of them?
The time falling bodies take to light, yes. That's 1981.
Thank you for I can trust you for remembering the right thing. But I did read that, and I found it beautiful.
Okay, he did many books since then. Now, here's a pattern he puts out about 1989. In the pre-Neolithic phase, he said that the victim was the animal and the complex, the social structure was matriarchy. Then he moved to the next level, and the complex was patriarchy, and the victim was the woman. Then he says, you get into the...
Which was the next... What was the call? What would be called that period?
The Neolithic. And
no, the first one is the one... you mean the Neolithic is the second one. Oh.
Yeah, Neolithic is agricultural. Before that
roving bands. Okay, I get you. No, I'm sorry.
So he has this interesting thing. He describes the ground. He calls the first level matriarchy, but the victim is the animal. Then I think it is the next one eventually gets to the patriarchy, is the ground, the complex he called it, and the victim is the woman. And then he goes into the next one, say Roman civilizations, the complex is geometrical civilization, and the victim is religion, and that's the industrial phase. So the art and science take over; they're the complex 400, 500 years ago. So the victim is religion. Now, what's interesting in the planetary phase, the present over the last 30 years. The complex is music. Remember McLuhan said we live entirely by music. and the victim is the mind. And I thought that was very
appropriate. That's very perceptive. Yeah, it is very perceptive.
Yeah, because now he could mean the left hemisphere mind. It's hard to tell what mind is, but I think it's a great statement about what the depth of the identity crisis in this participatory global theater, global membrane, that people can't get a perspective, which is supposedly what the mind's for, right? You get a detachment or perspective.
Yeah,
and so I was thinking about that lately, how we don't have minds in any sense. And so you're attracted to your personality and its mirror. So you have many people who would never engage in politics, don't take it seriously. You have many people who won't engage in sports, and others won't engage in music, and others won't engage in business. You got all these fragmented little nano hives or nano communities. All right?
Right.
And they're decentralized and operating within their desires and what they can achieve, including, you could say, that since the 80s, the bartering that goes on. And people aren't in the economy. They're surviving through all kinds of other ways. So why do we look to the White House as a leadership image? Personally, they're not leading me. I'm aware of all kinds of different people who do not take politics seriously. Who is the group that's taking it seriously? Is it the TV stations, because they make a lot of money supposedly out of these elections?
Actually, you know, it goes back to the question of how much power a single man has at the head of the United States. I mean, basically, it is, unless you cut through the Gordian knot at every turn, which is what you can take from somebody, you can fear from somebody like Donald Trump, you basically, your power is mitigated across all kinds of alliances and, you know, pre-existing states of the state, so to speak. So the power that people have in that circumstance is very, very much delegated to the bureaucracies. They are the power, as they are in Canada.
Well, that's the environment. That's a certain collection of technologies.
Yeah, it is, and there's a lot of self-protection and self-organizing, working not at odds, but finding an agreement. How much in a bureaucracy can you reconcile tradition and individual talent, so to speak?
Right. Okay.
That's what's happening, and I see that will continue, and it actually is the backbone of a democratic system.
Okay.
As bad as it is.
Right, but now to throw this point in, McLuhan started saying in the 70s that we're in a situation where we have government by committee, and he is on record as saying that if you were the actual president, you wouldn't do anything.
That's right, but I'm back to your question, though. Let's get back to this one later.
Yeah.
Back to your question was, you know, how can we believe these guys? We don't need to believe these guys. They and Hockey Night in Canada are on a par.
Yes.
They are entertainment. The media know it. The pretense that they are connected to reality is what justifies the media attention, but it is fake, and they know it. We don't all know it, but we should know it. And it's a joke. It really is. But it's
a joke
we can't get out of.
All right. Now, that's what partly people are mad at. That's been the case for 25 years. They don't like where the media has taken them, where the technological android meme has brought us.
And they're right to be mad. They're mad as hell, and they won't take it anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
They're right. I'm not saying that they're wrong, and I'm not saying that expressing that anger through voting or accepting Trump it may be a mistake, but it's not fascist in itself. It simply can lead to fascism, and I think it's not good.
Well, no, I don't think it leads to fascism. We're the most fascist in many substructures in bureaucracy that anybody could ever be. Everybody sees it on TV every night. Everybody accepts the fact if you go too far, some little private death squad is going to kill you and get away with it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people accept that level of paranoia and don't worry about other people getting killed. But you could say this year, more and more people got involved in politics. They became concerned for some reason this past 6 months, and they've taken over the election process. You know, these mobs, these the huge people showing up for Bernie Sanders, the huge people showing up for Trump, that all of a sudden these people who don't vote, I mean, I've heard people say that they shake hands with Trump and they say, you know, I've 80-year-old women say, I've never voted before, but you've got me out. So there's some kind of huge whirlpool of emotion going on that people think it's time we take over. And, of course, they're naive, and they think by going to the White House or something, they'll have some say in the matter. And they don't study their McLuhan or any relevant thinker and realize how everything is beyond that. They can get out their Arthur Croker and realize how the machines have taken over. There's depths that you can go in, and the kids are taught this stuff in universities. You have Kathleen Hales, her book, How We Became Posthuman. That's standard fare in college, right? So
yeah.
The kids are taught that they're posthuman.
That's right, sort of what, you know.
What? What'd you say?
So that gives them a great deal of freedom of choice.
Yeah. Yeah. But, do you know that woman?
Catherine, yes, I did. I did meet her, and I think she's a very, very respected in the arts and technology and, you know.
The parents.
New thinking.
And I don't know if there's any parents anymore, but those people who are paying for their children to go to college, they think they're getting some kind of education that they got as baby boomers or something, or Generation X 20, 30 years ago. Wouldn't they be, you know, she's rather very proper looking, almost dowdy, you know, she's a gray eminence almost, Kathy.
Yeah, well, they are. No, they're
but would the, par- would the parents believe, or do they understand that this woman is famous by saying, we became post-human? So the parent has to say, what, we're post-human? What do you mean we're post-human? You see, the concepts in universities are not being exposed to the adults that are paying for it.
So it's true that there's a problem there. But being post-human, however, the way she describes this is not sufficiently clear to me. But
yeah.
I don't know. Did you find it instructive?
Well, you know, here's what's happening. I was reading the book on September 11th, 2001. And it was on page 222 when I got word of what was happening to the Twin Towers. So I thought it was pretty symbolic that I was reading her book, because Frank Zingroni told me that she's going to be incredible in 100 years and she'll be considered a great mind. And she's pretty good at analyzing Philip K. Dick and the literary world and the history of the Macy conferences and all that she does in the book. But as usual, they do not understand McLuhan with any depth. And they're weak there. They're weak in that part that we're experts on. Do you know what I mean? So I'm never impressed with these people that they put up. Because I could go a lot further than saying we're post-human.
I didn't read that one. I read the We're All Cyborgs and the Cyborg Manifesto. And I think the post-human, she's not the only one. There's a great deal of post-human.
I think you're thinking of Donna Haraway.
Oh, you're right. No, you're right. Excuse
me. That's the Cyborg Manifesto. You may not have read.
Yeah. I'm confusing. And it's Donna Haraway that I met. I met her in Amsterdam, but I don't. No, you're right. I may not have met her.
She was the beginning. She started that in the 80s, and she was the first. And then Kathleen Hales built up on it and moved it further.
No, I haven't met Kathleen Hales. I met Donna Haraway. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm getting a senior moment.
Yeah, and you would be Donna Haraway because she's on your circuit of lectures. You know what I mean? The people that you are asked to speak for, at least back then. Mm. She's now become obsessed with her pets. It's interesting what's happened to her. She's kind of gone nuts. I don't know if you followed what happened to her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she writes about trying to communicate with species, with dogs or pets. And now Coker has done a book on this, Body Drift, and he analyzes Judith Butler, Haraway and Kathleen Hales. He takes those three people, and he says these women are brilliant. And one's a replay of Nietzsche, one's a replay of Heidegger, and maybe one's a replay of Marx. I can't remember, but he's saying these women are redoing these great thinkers in the kind of a canon that Croker likes to read a lot about. And he lays them out: Haraway, Butler, and Hales.
Yeah, they're in. They've been in for a long time. They have been intellectual leaders in universities, all three of them.
Yes.
In departments which were more awakened than most.
Yeah.
There is no question about that. They're all very interesting. I read also bits and pieces here and there of all of them.
Yes.
And I sort of, but it's been a while, I have to admit, that I haven't gone into that. But you see, they also benefit from a legitimate international feminist trend.
Yes.
To give women the right to speak and to actually grant them as much authority in their speak, writing, and so on as men. And I think this is an absolutely wonderful thing. I fully agree. And I was the first to ask for that, but I did it in 75 at the International Year of the Women.
Yeah, listen. Let's deal with that point, because it's on your documentary you did on McLuhan in 1980, just before he passed away, where you have McLuhan saying, and he might have been saying it to Edwin Newman in 1970, but it was a really important quote. He says, "The women will take over the old bureaucracies, the old institutions, while men will move into surveillance." That's a really important point.
So the men go back to the military order.
Yeah.
Defense.
But that includes advertising and daily espionage, McLuhan said we were all engaged in. But it was interesting that... So you have these three women replaying Nietzsche, Marx, and Heidegger.
Yeah.
Because it's book culture they're doing. And now they're allowed to be left hemisphere book people, while their actual ex-husbands and friends of their fathers are running around doing death squads and all that stuff they show every night on TV, like The House of Cards or any other drastic, Homeland, this incredible... violence and murdering and saving us all from these terrorists that are done behind the scenes, and we don't know anything about it, and they don't get rewarded. It's remained anonymous, right? Don't you think House of Cards and these TVs, why TV shows are a bit better, is they're actually showing with no holds barred what is probably going on?
Yeah, the best, I would say, form of democratic government criticism that in America gets away with it is cinema. Tons of films have been made about how corrupt the government really is.
But it's also in TV shows, weekly.
Cinema and video. Those TV shows are forever finding something wrong with the government. Absolutely.
Now, I think that they had an influence the last couple of years on the election, this election. Have you ever seen Veep? V-E-E-P.
No, I never have. What was that?
That is the woman who was on Seinfeld. What's her name? Julia Dreyfus or something? Yeah, Julia Dreyfus.
You're talking to a very poorly educated man.
All right. Anyways, I would say it is the best replay, what goes on in Washington or what's supposed to be going on, that you could ever get. It's a half-hour show. It's the most hilarious show. But she was vice president. Then she became president, and they're in a total, constant panic. Her aides are always polling, calling. They're always making mistakes. It's total chaos, and I think that's what you get, that the accuracy of that. I recommend you can go on any archive network and see Veep, V-E-E-P. I know you like Person of Interest. I think you told me about that, right?
I've grown out of it because it's the most exciting part for me as somebody who's always been close to writing was the actual innovation in the situations they were. The characters got on my nerves after a while. You predict them so badly, they're part of your family. But the situations were brilliant. Now I'm sort of, what am I exploring? Yeah, I'm into Continuum. I think it's a Canadian series, too.
Continuum, I don't know that. I think I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it.
No, it's not bad. It's also, how god-awful governments are and how corrupt institutions like FBI and other things are. It's kind of an extended Blacklist.
Yes, I watched the Blacklist. Are you up on that? Did you see what happened this week? The big finale happened.
No, I haven't found out any. I haven't. No, I haven't seen what's happened. No,
I can tell you, but it's pretty interesting for ending the season. A big flip happened, huge flip.
It was this season, this week. You mean?
Yeah, it was last week, Thursday night. I see it.
Okay, so maybe I'll get it on Netflix or something. But it's good.
Yeah.
Anyway, I love these things. Partly because of my literary training, and I transfer that to cinema for various purposes, and of course TV, but partly also because they do reveal a lot of, they are metaphors, or even though they are parallels.
Well, they're actually the facts, probably.
And so, they are more likely than not based on, I'll tell you, my experience of how consensus is quickly drawn in Washington around issues that you can or cannot talk about was being with a Washington Post journalist at a party, or a dinner party, in fact, next to him, and commenting on my doubts about the report, the 911 report that had just come out.
Yeah.
He looked at me with absolute horror in his eyes, and he said, "Well, you must be crazy. It's absolutely true."
Wow.
You know, so.
But see, there's the point. To do these old institutions, journalism, TV producers, all the regular analog media positions or roles or jobs, you actually have to be quite dumb or just be a zombie, a robot. You take McLuhan's definition of the president. What is the president? He did this to Take Today. He's an automated presidential surrogate who's a superlative nobody. That's his definition of the president. Automated presidential surrogate. So he's not the real president. The real president, whoever's in charge, is the people behind the scene and the intelligence agencies. And he has to be a superlative nobody.
Yeah.
And I would say that could be applied to all these regular old media jobs. So it doesn't surprise me that a well-functioning journalist, a guy working for the Washington Post, he has to adopt the party line that there's no real conspiracies going on. They're not allowed to write on that level. And he became what he beheld.
Yeah, no, it's more than likely true. It's another metaphor. It's just that I am sort of concerned about, you know, a dictator is precisely the kind of person that takes over a government to do just what he wants. And that can happen. Now, can it happen in the United States?
I don't think so.
It wouldn't be that easy.
There are groups. You represent a group, and probably the most active, potentially powerful group is the Secret Service, because they can take over things and no one would know.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is, and that's why so much of the folklore is based on looking into that.
Yeah.
There is a lot of cinematic examination, and you know, let's face it. I mean, that's why the world of cinema and the world of media don't concur.
Well, okay, wait a minute.
Now,
when you say the world media, that's the word that makes the market. That's McLuhan's phrase.
No, I didn't say the media. I said cinema.
I know. You said cinema versus media, I thought.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And I'm saying the media is the word that makes the market. And that must always maintain that it's never gotten out of hand. They must always say that we're sort of in control. A little nervous, but we'll get back in control. Whereas
yes.
The cinema part, the hologram part, is in a state of panic, hysteria, and ecstasy, and schizophrenia constantly, 24/7.
Yes.
And that's what people mostly live. And then every 4 years, they pretend to, you have to be a very sane person. The population vets you, you know, the vetting process is here, and they're all worried of Trump. He's obviously insane.
So the message of cinema is that disaster is a fiction.
That disaster is fiction?
Yes. Real disaster is nothing but a fiction.
No. The message of cinema is telling you what's actually happening. And you know.
No, agreed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the way of the media of letting the cinema be, you know, and of the power of letting cinema be is actually a vaccine.
Vaccine. Is that Belgium? Is that how you guys say it?
I love to transform words. My you know what? I live in Italy, and I have to invent words every day. So I've gotten into the habit.
Yes. Well, I got into the habit reading Finnegan's Wake for 40 years of saying words wrong. Yeah, because when you read Finney's Wake, you have to sort of say it different ways. So I actually say many normal words wrong.
No, and I do it on purpose. You know, I mean, sometimes it's a derogatory way. It's all kinds of use to do it.
Right.
I play with words all the time. I really do.
Now,
I love them.
We're not just rambling talking about our favorites. There's a point here. We're trying to show what the different bodies, the different landscapes we're dealing with. We come up with a nice dialectic. The media are the stable rationality patina that goes on, while all other media try to make reality seem so screwed up and dangerous, you know, from gangster rap to Homeland or House of Cards, and that's free creativity, free improvisation, imaginative scenarios, which is actually what's going on. But the media must say, no, that's not going on. There's no conspiracy 911. You see what I mean? It's all mixed up.
But it's I don't think it's mixed up. I think on the contrary, it's terribly organized. It actually works to, it's dialectic. I think the media and cinema are emotionally dialectic. They're picked up by the networks anyway, because emotions travel on networks.
Yes.
Very fast.
So
and so I think that there is.
Oh, let me throw in what you mean. How did McLuhan define Watergate? Do you know that one?
Can't remember it.
Yeah. He said it was a battle between the newspaper and the TV world over the advertising dollar. So the newspaper were not as grounding as Walter Cronkite and the TV stations. So the newspaper, he said, became the underground press. Washington Post, New York Times, they became the agitators. And they're up against the stabilized Walter Cronkite. And Dan Rathers was saying, oh, no, everything's okay. It's not that bad. So he's talking about it as a battle between media forms. Newspaper versus television for the advertising dollar. Now, there's no people involved in that, no individual will or control. But the will and control would be in the intelligence agencies, in the Secret Service, or whatever group has got the black box and is going to determine whether the bomb's going to be dropped or not. You know what I mean?
I do. Actually, I did see it at work, again, a brilliant film called Focus, I think it was, about the journalists in Boston, one of the Boston Globe or Herald, God knows which one, competing for, of course, readership. Now, not against television so much, but against all other media. They're trying to carve itself a new position and use its special unit to investigate pedophilia in Boston. And,
oh, I saw that. That's the big film this year.
Yes, isn't it called Focus? I thought it
was. No, it's Shopping or Shipwrecked or SH or something. I just saw it. Software or so. It was not Focus. It was.
I thought it was Focus, but anyway.
Shop Order. It's funny. I don't remember.
You remember what it was?
No, that
about.
Was a good. That was a good show.
Very good show.
And showing the what would appear to be cowardice by the journalist, like the older guy who led the investigative group. He was very nervous about ever implying this because of the power of the church. And then it sort of showed you slowly how the news the newspaper had to go intense and violate the church because they need to look like they're doing something.
Yeah. No, it's true. Did you see Newsroom speaking about
yes,
it?
Yes, I watched all that. Yeah.
I didn't watch all of it because it ended up being too confusing and I didn't have time to catch the people that I had been missing.
But no, Spotlight.
I loved
Is it Spotlight? Was that the name of the movie?
Spotlight. You got it.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I've got to stop. You mind if I stop for about 10, 20 minutes because I am my kids have just arrived.
Okay, no. So I will we'll hang up and we'll call you back and start another recording.
Okay. So, but you know, give me a little, I'll send you a mail to say when I'm ready. Okay.
Okay. Yes, it's only 5:30 here, so that's okay.
Fine.
Okay.
All right.
I'll stop this recording. Thanks.
Bye.